I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear an interview that radio show host Frank Tolupko and I did with Barbara Honegger while attending the Toronto hearings on September 10, 2011. Frank hosts a radio show in Great Barrington, Mass. Called The 9/11 Report. He's also one of the founding members of the website Media for 9/11 Truth, along with myself, Mike DeRosa, and a few others. You can go there and sign the petition for a new independent investigation, even if you're not involved in the media. The website is mediafor911truth.org. But back to the interview with Barbara Honegger. Her background is provided in the context of the interview, so let's get started.
Frank Tolupko and I are here at the International Toronto Hearings in Toronto, Canada. It's September 10th, and we're speaking with Barbara Honegger. Barbara, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background and when you and why you became interested in challenging the official story of 9/11?
Right. Well, my background, I've held a number of high positions in the federal government. I was White House policy analyst and also special assistant to the president. That's in the early 1980s in the West Wing of the White House. I've held a high-level position in the U.S. Department of Justice. And for the past 15 years, until my retirement only about 2 months ago, I was the senior military affairs journalist at the Department of Defense's premier science, technology, and national security affairs university.
When did you first get interested in challenging the official account of 9/11?
Oh, on 9/11.
I mean, what was it about that day that made that happen?
There's always a trigger. But first off, I'm the author of October Surprise. And October Surprise is the book that is now fully vindicated by internal, formerly classified documents, that my book was the first by 3 years before anyone else's, that showed that there was a theft of the 1980 election in the Reagan-Bush 1980 campaigns, illegal and treasonous dealing with the Khomeini regime to delay the release of our 52 hostages to defeat President Carter. So I have an inherent suspicion of anything that the government says or does. I just think it's a healthy suspicion. In other words, I expect that my government to have to prove anything that they say. I don't take anything they say on faith. So the moment that 9/11 happened, I was just, you know, I wasn't going to believe the official story without them proving it, and they've done everything but prove it. But more than that, the event that I saw on television as it was happening, actually, interestingly, Lori Van Auken, one of the Jersey girls, in the testimony here at the hearing, she was the very first witness the first day by videotape. She mentioned this exact same event that triggered me. And that was, I was watching television. I don't recall at the time, but I do have notes, which mainstream television station. But there was a split screen with President Bush sitting, continuing to read to grammar school students about a pet goat for at least 10, and other reports say as many as 12 or 15 minutes, after being told that the second tower was hit in New York City. And on that split screen, there were innocent Americans jumping to their deaths from the Twin Towers while the President of the United States did nothing. And I thought, this reeks to high heaven, reeks to high heaven. So the equivalent event when I did my book October Surprise was when I watched TV and I saw that the 52 hostages were released literally as Reagan took his oath of office. It smelled to high heaven. And all of my years of research after that resulted in the book October Surprise, which in turn resulted in a full subpoena power House of Representatives investigation under federal law. So, yes, that was the event that started me on this quest.
Just quickly, I'm writing a novel, hopefully, on the events of the day. I just want to get your reaction. That scene where Bush is sitting there and Andy Carter whispers into his ear,
right,
and then he goes blank and sits there for eight.
It's like a deer in the headlights.
A deer in the headlights. Everybody says, as you just said, that total inaction, the country's being attacked and what's going on. My take on it is, hey guys, you told me there was only going to be one plane.
Or, I think more likely, you told me the scenario of attacks on the Twin Towers was only an exercise.
Aha, that's another good take on it. Very good. Okay.
And by the way, let me add that some years later, and I have this on the clip from television, which you can see on YouTube, that Karl Rove was asked, I believe it was the 5th anniversary, but in any case, one of the, maybe the 6th, he was asked on a national television program, you know, how come the president just sat there after he was told by Andy Card that the Second World Trade Center was hit and the country was under attack? And Rove said, well, the president didn't want to, he wanted to wait for the drill to be over. Now, the common interpretation of that is that they were talking about the reading drill, but that really doesn't make sense. What we do now know, and I was the first researcher to uncover this and connect these dots, what we do now know, and it has been confirmed by Colonel Marr, who was the battlefield operational director at NORAD Northeast Sector on 9/11, which the very sector of NORAD which did not timely scramble the NORAD jets to intercept any of the four planes, Colonel Marr has now acknowledged in a book called Touching History, he's quoted by Lynn Spencer, the author, Marr has now acknowledged that NORAD Northeast Sector that he was in charge of was doing a hijack scenario exercise on the morning of 9/11. So I believe that that's the drill that Rove said Bush was waiting to be over. And in fact, it was only when the Pentagon was struck, which apparently was not part of the drill scenario, the exercise scenario on 9/11, which included hijack scenarios, when the Pentagon was struck, suddenly the Secret Service, and only then the Secret Service, acted as if it was a real attack.
Maybe that's a good segue for the substance of your talk here at the Toronto International Hearings about what actually happened or what you think actually happened at the Pentagon.
Here's the bottom line. I don't just believe, but I know. The evidence is overwhelming, multiple, compelling, independent, converging lines of evidence that there were massive internal explosions inside the Pentagon that began at least 6 minutes and as many as 7 minutes before the official lie says anything hit the building from the outside. And the first violent event inside the Pentagon happened right after 9:30. We know that from a key inside witness, April Gallup's stopped wristwatch. As she pressed the on button on her computer that morning, the explosion, the first huge explosion happened, which almost killed her.
Is that an explosion within her computer or around her?
Well, we don't know, but what we do know is that it was instantaneous. She presses the on button on her computer, and whether coincidental or not, she doesn't believe so, and I don't either, and I can tell you why if you'd like. But the moment she pressed the on button on her computer, right after 9:30, it was like 9:31 and a half, that the first massive explosion went on inside the Army area of the Pentagon, which had the most deaths. But miraculously, she survived. She walked out of the alleged entrance hole of the alleged plane that allegedly impacted the building, saw no plane, no plane parts. Her desk was only about 30, 35 feet from the alleged plane impact hole that she walked out of. She wasn't burned. There was no jet fuel. There was no plane parts, no luggage, no bodies from a plane, no seats. And then there are photographs of her in my PowerPoint presentation showing that even though she walked out with one bare foot, that her feet are completely unburned. The official story simply cannot be correct from April Gallup's testimony. But hers was just one of many lines of evidence. Her wristwatch stopped right after 9:30 with the explosion that happened simultaneously as the wristwatch stopped, as she pressed the on button on her computer. And there are stop clocks throughout the Pentagon and one in the heliport that's even the official clock from 9/11, a stop clock in the Smithsonian Institution exhibit. Stopped right after 9:30.
I've been often proposed this scenario, having read your materials, and invariably the answer I get is, oh, you know institutional clocks, they're all over the place. How true could that be for the Pentagon? I've actually heard this argument.
Well, first off, I'm not sure what that argument is, but if by that they mean that there are many clocks throughout the Pentagon, I mean, that's a ridiculous argument because it's only the ones that would have been damaged in the area of the explosion that would have stopped. So it's a non sequitur. It's ridiculous. We have multiple stop clocks right after 9:30. One in the Navy area, which received the largest per capita number of deaths for its functional area. According to the official story, 43 of 44 or 42 of 43, one of the other, of all the personnel in the Naval Command Center died. It was targeted by inside explosives, absolutely targeted. And the other area that had the most absolute number of deaths, however, there were also a larger percentage of survivors in that area because it had more overall personnel than the Naval Command Center was the Army area where April Gallop was. And those are the two places where the clock stopped, obviously, where the explosions were.
Was this the area that had just completed or was about to complete the renovations? And would that offer opportunity for the scenario you're presenting?
Oh, that's an interesting question. By area, just to be clearer, the entire west wedge of the Pentagon was in the process of a number of years-long renovation and security upgrade. So what they had done is they had put blast-proof window glass only in that wedge. So there, the Pentagon, obviously Pentagon, it has five sides. The west side was the one that they were going to renovate it and upgrade it wedge by wedge, piece by piece. And the Pentagon, of course, has five rings in. It's a Pentagon. It has five sides. It has five different rings in. The outside ring is the E ring, and the inside ring is the A ring. So the official story says that a plane impacted at an oblique or diagonal angle into the outside of the west wedge. Well, after the renovation, which was almost complete, and the outside of the building was complete of the security upgrade, they had added a kind of Kevlar. You've heard of, you know, bulletproof vests. They'd add a kind of Kevlar mesh material inside the concrete. It was something like 6 feet of concrete, and then another at least, I believe it was 5 inches of brick, and then another few inches of limestone on the outside of that with this Kevlar reinforced material, which was designed to preclude damage to the inside of just that west wedge. Now, if by your question you mean, would the construction of that have afforded opportunities for the planting of bombs on the inside? Is that your question?
Yes.
Not the way that the evidence shows. For instance, we have really overwhelming evidence that the so-called C-ring, so-called exit hole, which was not an exit of a plane or a plane part at all, and I proved that in my talk, it was in fact made by a shaped charge explosive, which is a charge that you, an explosive that you put on the wall, like the Army Corps of Engineers uses these, and many others, the explosive demolition experts in the military. You put them on a wall in order to blow an almost perfectly round hole in the wall. And the so-called exit hole is in fact made by a shaped charge. And it is my belief that the hole on the outside of the E-ring where the alleged entrance hole of the plane was also made by a shaped charge explosive because it's approximately the same size. But in any case, the other explosive damage was too particular to individual internal offices that didn't have walls. One thing that people don't know, in other words, those explosives, bombs, whatever they were massive explosions. Whatever their cause or source was had to have been planted in a kind of an open space area. Because, for instance, in the case of April Gallop, whatever it was went off literally right around her as she pressed the on button on her own computer. And that was she described it as a very large open space with no desks in the middle and just desks around the outside ring. So there wouldn't be any walls there to put the explosives in.
Are there any other witnesses or survivors of the Pentagon that are as outspoken as April Gallop that you get information from?
Yes, interestingly enough. In fact, I have interviewed the topmost officials of the Pentagon. The position that I had at the Naval Postgraduate School gave me access to General Ralph Eberhard, the head of NORAD on 9/11. I interviewed, for instance, the Assistant Secretary, the person who had been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations on 9/11, Robert Andrews, former top Green Beret, Army Green Beret Special Operations Officer. And he told me that he and his aide on the morning of 9/11, not too long after the second tower was hit, just minutes, so that would have made it at the very latest probably about 9:15 in the morning because the second tower was hit at 9:03, that he and his aide had to step over dead bodies on the inside of the A ring. Now, the official story states that even if a plane did hit the building, it only penetrated into the inside of the middle or C ring. And yet we have witnesses that were all over the news that in my presentation, I give their quotes from the Washington Times and the Washington Post and the New York Times, that there was massive damage and deaths on the inside of the B ring, which is inside the A ring, and also on the very inside, according to Robert Andrews himself, who was right under Donald Rumsfeld on 9/11, on the inside of the A ring, just by the courtyard.
Mm. And that's the innermost ring.
That is the innermost ring, yes.
There's a rift in the 9/11 truth movement around the Pentagon and plane or no plane and stuff, and I wondered if you could react or talk about that.
Oh, well, first off, it's unfortunate. But the first point I would like to make is that there is a dissension or a disagreement or a debate, if you will, and it sometimes becomes a very acerbic or toxic debate, and which I happen to personally believe is being intentionally fomented by infiltrators, Cass Sunstein infiltrators in the movement. But that debate is over whether, number one, there are two things it's a debate about, over one, whether a 757, which is what Flight 77 was, whether a large commercial Boeing 757 hit the building at all, whether it was Flight 77 or not, because there are other Boeing 757s, that's the first debate. The second debate is, if a large plane of any kind approached the building that morning, which many witnesses saw, did it approach on the official story light pole path, where the light poles were knocked down, which is called the South Path because it's south of the Citgo gas station, if you look at the map or an aerial map of the Pentagon, or was it the North Path? There are only about 12 or 13 witnesses for the North Path, and it's a completely different path. And the North Path plane, as seen by those witnesses, simply could not have knocked over the light poles. So there's dissension. But the beautiful thing is that my presentation makes it clear that you can completely demolish the official story as instantly as the World Trade Center towers were demolished on 9/11 by simply ignoring the plane controversy. Don't even go there. All you have to do is look at the evidence for the inside explosives almost 7 minutes before any of these people on either side of the plane debate say that something hit the building from the outside. The real story at the Pentagon, this is critical, the take-home message from my presentation here at the hearings is that the real story of 9/11 is the same at the Pentagon as it is at the World Trade Center. Inside the building, pre-planted explosives going off before any plane either hit, in the case of the World Trade Center tower. We know that from Willie Rodriguez's testimony, the wonderful janitor who had the only master key in World Trade Center 1 on 9/11. He and 24 other witnesses that he tried to take to the 9/11 commission, he and at least 24 other witnesses that he personally knows experienced deep basement explosions at least 8 to 9 seconds before the first plane hit the first tower, World Trade Center 1 on 9/11. So we know that there were explosions inside the World Trade Center before the first plane hit in New York. We know that there were massive controlled demolition explosive charges placed, cutter charges placed throughout World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 in New York, that the planes, the plane impacts and fires from the planes were simply the cover story for how the buildings came down, that the whole thing was pre-planned. And now I've added this critical, critical point that the real story at the Pentagon is also inside the building explosives long before the official story says anything approached and hit the building, even if it did hit.
When did you first publish to this effect?
Interesting. I published my Pentagon attack papers, and I keep updating it on the web. I'm guessing, but I believe that was about 2004. Yes, and my Pentagon attack papers, one of the earlier versions, has been published years ago in the appendix to Jim Mars's book on 9/11, the New York Times bestselling author Jim Mars, called The Terror Conspiracy. Now, the first edition of that book was called Inside Job. And when it was republished, his second edition and upgraded, my appendix was included. And it is also included in the third upgrade of his book. It's called The Terror Conspiracy Revisited, which was just released for the 10th anniversary.
The reason I ask that is I'm trying to set a chronology, because on the official White House website, there's a text of a speech given by then Vice President Dick Cheney, mm-hmm. at the 8th anniversary of the attack on the Pentagon, the event at the Pentagon.
So that would have been 2009.
I believe so, yes. Yeah. And they were, obviously the elections were coming up, it was the end of their terms. And what Richard Cheney says in his speech is that, mm-hmm. you know, we're here to mourn the loss of all the people in the Pentagon, etc. An event that happened 8 years before at 9:41 in the morning and not 1 minute before. He actually says that.
Oh, I didn't know that. You've got to give me that. That's wonderful.
If it's not up there, I've printed it out, but he's actually
saying. He says 9:41
and not one minute
okay,
before.
Now, that's very, very important.
He's coming out of office, and he seems to be setting the tone or reacting to what
did. Well, I don't know if it's to what I did per se, but let me just say this. It's been clear to me from the beginning that the entire, let me back up, The official time of the alleged impact of Flight 77 on the outside of the Pentagon on 9/11, the morning of 9/11, is 9:37 and 46 seconds. Where do they get that time? It comes from the alleged flight data recorder from allegedly taken from Flight 77, which they fraudulently claim they found inside the rubble of just inside the C-ring so-called exit hole, which I've already proven to you is not an exit hole of a plane of any kind, inside the Pentagon. Now, that time is almost 9:48. The explosions went off inside the building just after 9:30. The clocks are stopped just after 9:31. April Gallup's watch is stopped after 9:31. They are scared to death that if anybody looks at any kind of a violent event at the Pentagon before their official story impact time, which is about 9:38, and now he's moving it out to 9:41, they don't want anybody to look earlier, because when you look earlier, you see the inside explosions. And inside explosions at the Pentagon, just as at the World Trade Center, can only be explained by internally pre-placed, pre-planned explosives, an inside job. The ultimate inside job is the Pentagon attack. Now, why does that really matter? Here at the Toronto hearings, which I consider the turning point for the 9/11 truth movement and world history, really. I really do. I can feel it.
I would agree with you. Yes. I feel the same thing.
We've broken through. This is going to be, as David Ray Griffin said in the Q&As after his talk the first day here, he said, I believe that we will look back and say it all changed at these hearings. Mm-hmm. In any case, and when he said it all changed, to break through to eventually to the mass media, or maybe directly in some way to public perception by going around the mass media, but we will see. But I agree with him. This is the turning point. In any case, why is this so important? It's the Pentagon attack, knowing and being able to prove, which I have done, that the Pentagon attack is inside the building explosives a long time before the official story says anything even approached the building, whether it was a plane or a missile or a drone or Santa Claus's sleigh. You know, it doesn't matter. What's important about that is I've proven an inside job at the Pentagon. And when you prove that the Pentagon attacked itself, then you realize that it's the Pentagon attack that is the core of the real plot of the inside perpetrators, the inside mass murderers of the real plot of 9/11. And that is the new Pearl Harbor. Many of the speakers here, including the panelists, the judges, if you will, at these hearings, have said, I don't really understand. Why would they plant explosives in World Trade Center 7? And maybe the motives are different than whoever planted the controlled demolition charges in World Trade Center 1 and 2 in New York. That doesn't really constitute a new Pearl Harbor for me. Well, but the Pentagon attack does. Pearl Harbor was a key military facility in order to have their new Pearl Harbor, which the neocons, in their Project for a New American Century manifesto, published over a year, some people have told me exactly a year before 9/11, on September 11th, 2000. I still have to check that.
Maybe the other metaphor is that it's our Reichstag fire.
Well, it is a Reichstag fire. There's no question about it. Although, there is some reason to believe that Flight 93 might have intended to target the Capitol Dome, which would have been the true Reichstag fire.
Is there a website where the listeners can go to get more information about your materials, your work, your research?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I will give you and then you can add it because I have to get it out of my briefcase. But I will give you the links to, there are two links because it's in two parts, a two-hour presentation that I've spent about 9 months doing, making very professional, that covers all the information that I've covered here in Toronto. It's already on the web, and anyone can go and watch it, and then it will be a bit of time before my presentation is available on the web from this conference, because it takes time for the conference organizers to get it up. But yes, I will give you those links. I don't have a website because I spend all my time doing the research. Okay. But people can contact me directly at pentagonattackpapers, that's plural, @gmail.com.
So pentagonattackpapers@gmail.com. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners, anything you want them to know that we haven't already discussed?
That's a pretty broad question. Well, I would hope that your listeners already, having listened to your program before, have quite a bit of background about 9/11 truth. Can I assume that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. They're not novices to 9/11 truth. For anyone who already knows something about 9/11 truth, it's the take-home message is, here at the Toronto hearings on the events of 9/11, there have been testimony after expert testimony after expert testimony, which you will be able to see in videotape soon on the web yourself. Watch all 4 days, because it will be a life-changing experience, even for those of us who are inside the 9/11 Truth Movement. It has been proven here to a panel of judges, one of whom is the honorary Chief Justice of the Italian Supreme Court, that what really happened on 9/11 was pre-planned inside building explosives at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, that we have proven an inside job. Therefore, the United States government attacked itself in what I would call a preemptive self-attack, which they want you to believe is a defensive attack, but it was not. It was a preemptive self-attack on the facilities of the United States federal government, on the Pentagon of the United States, that was the new Pearl Harbor. They wanted a new Pearl Harbor. They said they wanted one in their Project for New American Century manifesto published a year before 9/11. And the very people who signed that document calling for a new Pearl Harbor and were behind the attack on that, quote, Pearl Harbor, which was the Pentagon on 9/11.
Thank you, Barbara Heiniger, for sharing your time and your thoughts with our listeners.
Thank you.
It's very interesting but yet disturbing information.
It is, but I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, and I'm sure none of you also wouldn't be doing what you're doing, if I didn't have a deep abiding faith that what we are in the middle of doing this work is a citizen's enlightenment. We are insisting that the truth, that the evidence, that the scientific evidence, that the application of logic to the scientific facts and the evidence must stand, and that the official lie must fall. Until the official lie falls and is seen to fall, as quickly and as completely as the World Trade Center towers on 9/11. Not only American citizens, but all citizens of the world will not be able to come out from under this shroud of the great lie that has justified and been used as a pretext for an illegal, horrendous world domination agenda by our own country, the United States of America, which must be brought to a world court and held accountable.
Barbara Heiniger, thank you for speaking with us today.
And now I'm going to read parts of an article about the trial of the underwear bomber. It's called Bombshell: Underwear Bomber Calls Haskell as Defense Witness, written by Paul Joseph Watson. And it was posted on Infowars.com on Monday, October 10th. And here goes. In a shocking development in the trial of the accused underwear bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, Delta Flight 253 eyewitness Kurt Haskell has been called by Abdulmutallab as a witness for the defense, a move that could blow the whole case wide open. Detroit lawyer Haskell has been a prominent skeptic of the government's official version of events, having witnessed a well-dressed man help Abdulmutallab clear security before the incident on Christmas Day 2009, despite the fact that the bomber had no passport. In addition to the fact that his own father had warned U.S. intelligence officials of the threat posed by Abdulmutallab a month before the attempted attack. It later emerged that the State Department was ordered not to revoke Abdulmutallab's visa by federal counterterrorism officials, even though the accused bomber had known terrorist ties. Haskell maintains that Abdulmutallab was carrying a fake bomb and was the unwitting dupe in a case of government entrapment. He says, "I will be up to the task. I realize that some may not agree with me and may attempt to harm me. Nevertheless, I will speak the truth and not be intimidated. I will do this for the common good of all citizens of the United States." Haskell pointed out that if Abdulmutallab chooses to reveal what he knows about the entire plot, it could be more damaging to the Obama administration than the Fast and Furious scandal, and would undermine the entire foundation of the war on terror and the TSA grope downs and body scans that were introduced in the aftermath of the event. Abdulmutallab could reveal which intelligence agents gave him the dud bomb while also lifting the lid on the role of Anwar al-Awlaki, who, as we have documented, was clearly a double agent posing as an al-Qaeda leader while doing the bidding of the U.S. intelligence community. Aware that his involvement in the case and his assertions of government complicity in the aborted attack could put his life in danger, Haskell made it clear on air that he was not planning on committing suicide. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.